Melinda Snodgrass. A writer whose work crosses several mediums and genres, Melinda M. Snodgrass has written scripts for television shows such as Profiler and Star Trek The Next Generation, for which she was also a story editor for several years, written a number of popular SF novels, and was one of the co-creators of the long-running Wildcard series, for which she has also written and edited. Her novels include Circuit, Circuit Breaker, Final Circuit, The Edge of Reason, Runespear with Victor Milan, High Stakes, Santa Fe, and Queen's Gambit Declined. Her most recent novel is The Edge of Ruin, the sequel to The Edge of Reason. Her media novels include the Wild Cards novel Double Solitaire and the Star Trek novel The Tears of the Singers. She's also the editor of the anthology A Very Large Array. She lives in New Mexico. Here, she takes us to a distant planet to show us that even in a society where spaceships thunder through the night and aliens mingle with humans on crowded city streets, some of the games you might run into go way back.
The Hands That Are Not There by Melinda Snodgrass, read for you by Jonathan Frakes. Glass met glass, with dull, tuneless clunks, as the human bartender filled orders. A Hajin waitress with a long and tangled red mane running down her bare back clicked on delicate hooves through the bar delivering drinks. The patrons were a surly lot, mere shadows huddled in the dark dive and carefully seated at tables well away from each other. No one talked. Substituting for conversation were commentators calling the action of a soccer game playing on the wall screen over the bar. Even those voices were growling rumbles because the sound was turned down so low. The odor of spilled beer and rancid cooking oil twisted through the smoke, but they and the tobacco smells were trumped by the sense of despair and simmering anger. This dank hole was a perfect match for Second Lieutenant Tracy Bellmanner's mood. He had picked it because it was well away from the spaceport and he was unlikely to meet any of his shipmates. He should have been happy. He had graduated from the Solar League's military academy only last month and had been assigned to his first posting. Problem was, his fellow classmates had walked out as newly minted first lieutenants, but such was not the case for the low-born tailor's son who had attended the academy on a scholarship. When he had received his insignia, he'd stared down at the stars and single bar and realized that he was one rung below his aristocratic classmates. Even though his grades had been better, his performance in flight, the equal of any of them save Mercedes, whose reflexes and ability to withstand high G had put them all to shame. When he'd looked up at the commandant of the high ground, Vice Admiral Sergei Arrington Vazquez y Markov, the big man had casually delivered the explanation, totally unaware how insulting it had been. "You must understand, Bellmanner, it wouldn't do for you to be in the position of issuing orders to your classmates, especially to the Infanta Mercedes. This way, you will never hold the bridge solo and so be spared the embarrassment." The implication that he would be embarrassed to issue an order to high-born assholes, including the Emperor's daughter, had ignited his too-quick temper. "I'm sure that will be a great comfort to me as I'm dying because one of those idiots wrecked the ship." But of course, he hadn't said that. The unwary words had been at the edge of his teeth, but after 4 years being drilled in protocol and the chain of command, he managed to swallow the angry retort. Instead, he had saluted and managed a simple, "Yes, sir." At least he hadn't thanked Markov for the insult. Later, he wondered why he hadn't spoken up. Cowardice? Was he really intimidated by the FFH? That was a terrible thought, for it implied that He did know his place. If he was honest with himself, that was why he hadn't attended the post-graduation ball. He knew that none of Mercedes's ladies-in-waiting would have accepted him as escort. He couldn't bring a woman of his own social strata, and Mercedes was the daughter of the emperor, and no one could ever know what they had shared, or that Tracy loved her, and that she loved him. So he didn't go to the ball. Instead, he stood on the Crystal Bridge on Ring Central and watched Mercedes, out of uniform, and a vision in crimson and gold, enter the ballroom on the arm of Honorius Sinclair Cullen, Knight of the Arches and Shells, Duke d'Argento, known casually as Boho, and Tracy's nemesis and rival. It should have been Tracy at her side, but that could never be. Tracy took a long pull on his whiskey, draining the glass. It was cheap liquor, and it etched pain down his throat and settled like a burning coal in his gut. Unlike the other morose and uncommunicative patrons, Tracy had chosen to sit at the bar. The bartender, a big man, the stripes on his apron imperfectly hiding the grime, nodded at Tracy's empty glass. Another? Sure, why the hell not? You've really been hammering these down, kid. Tracy looked up and was surprised by the kindness in the man's brown eyes. You gonna be able to find your way back to the ship? Whiskey gurgled into the glass. Maybe it would be better if I didn't. A rag emerged from the apron pocket and wiped down the steel surface of the bar. You don't want to do that. The League hangs deserters. Tracy downed the drink in one gulp and fought back nausea. He shook his head. Not me. They wouldn't look for me. They'd be glad the embarrassment has been quietly swept under the rug. Look, kid, you got troubles. I can see that. Wow, you always this perceptive. Cut the attitude. But the words were said mildly and with a faint smile. Look, if you want to feel better about the state of the galaxy and your place in it, you should talk to that guy. It may all be bullshit, but Rohan's got one hell of a story. Tracy looked in the direction of the pointing finger and saw a portly man of medium height seated at a corner table and cuddling an empty glass. His dark hair was streaked with gray, and his forehead overly large due to the receding hairline. The bartender moved to the far end of the bar and started filling the empty glasses on the Hajin's tray. Tracy looked again at the slumped man. On impulse, he snatched up his glass and walked over to the table. Jerking a thumb over his shoulder at the bartender, Tracy said, "He says you've got a good story that's going to put everything in perspective for me." Tracy kicked out a chair and sat down. He half hoped that the man would object and start a fight. Tracy was in the mood to hit somebody. And here on Wasua, unlike at the high ground, a fight wouldn't turn into a stupid duel. Tracy touched the scar at his left temple, a gift from Boho. A closer look at the man revealed the unlikeliness of a fight breaking out. There was no muscle beneath the fat, and dark, puffy bags hung beneath his eyes.
"Lauren doesn't believe me," Rohan said, "but it's all true."
Alcohol slurred the words, but Tracy could hear the aristocratic accent of a member of the Fortune 500. God knew he could recognize it. He'd been listening to it for 4 damn years. He even feared he'd begun to ape it. "Okay. I'll bite. What's all true?" The tip of the man's tongue licked at his lips.
"I could tell the story better with something to wet my throat," he said.
"Okay, fine." Tracy went back to the bar and returned with a bottle of bourbon. He slammed it down between them.
There. Now I've paid for the tale, so go on. Amaze me. Rohan drew himself up, but the haughtiness of the movement was undercut when he began swaying in his chair. A pudgy hand grabbed the edge of the table, and he stabilized. I am more, much more, than I seem.
Okay, Tracy drew out the word. The man looked around with exaggerated care.
I have to be careful. If they knew I was talking.
Yes? The man drew a finger across his throat. He leaned across the table. His breath was a nauseating mix of booze and halitosis.
What I'm going to tell you could shake the foundations of the League.
The drunk poured himself a drink, tossed it back, and continued.
But it happened, all of it, and it's all true. Listen and learn, young man.
Rohan refilled his glass, topped off Tracy's, and saluted with his glass. This time he settled for a sip rather than a gulp. Rohan sighed and no longer seemed focused on the young officer.
It all started when one of my aides arranged a bachelor party.
If a strip club could ever be considered tasteful, Rohan assumed that this one fit that bill. Not that he was an expert. This was his first time in such an establishment, where human women flaunted themselves, much to the fury of the church. So why had he agreed to join his staff at a stag party in honor of Canood's upcoming nuptials? The answer came easily. Because my wife's latest lover is the same age as my daughter, and this one was just too much. So his presence in the Cosmos Club was, what, payback? And how likely was it that Juliana would ever find out? Surpassingly small. And that she would care? Smaller yet. He blushed as a nearly naked hostess, her breasts and mons outlined with a jeweled harness, took their coats, and, with the graceful hand gestures of a trained courtesan, ushered them over to the smiling maitre d', a handsome man with a spade beard and sparkling black eyes. He led the group through tall double doors and into the club proper. The lighting in the main room was subdued, but recessed spotlights struck fire from the slowly rotating platforms that held beautiful naked women. The platforms were shaped like spiral galaxies, the stars formed by faux diamonds. Rohan stared at the rounded buttocks of the girls and wondered what those behinds looked like after a long night seated on the platforms. Between the platforms was a stage made of clear glass. A crystal pole thrust up, an aggressive statement, from the center of the stage. Waitresses dressed, no, make that accented, with the same kind of jeweled harness worn by the hostess, moved between the tables serving drinks and food. Rohan saw a brion croûte garnished with sour cherries go past on a tray, and the aromas from the kitchen were as good as anything he'd smelled in the city's finest restaurants. His belly gave a growl of appreciation. Yes, definitely an upscale establishment, catering to the wealthy and well-born of the FFH. Another anomaly struck him. There were no aliens present. The waitstaff were all humans, an expensive affectation. Rohan assumed that in the bowels of the kitchen, Hajin and Asanjo labored as dishwashers, but the image presented to the paying customers was aggressively human. John Fujisaki had reserved a circular booth at the edge of the stage. An ice-filled champagne bucket and the expected bottle were already waiting. As the party arranged themselves, The maitre d' opened the bottle with a discreet pop and filled their glasses. The upholstery was plush, made from neural fabric that sensed the tension in Rohan's lower back and began to massage the spot. The floating hollow table displayed a constantly shifting view of spectacular astronomical phenomena. Rohan stared, mesmerized, as a blossoming supernova tried to consume his drink. John Fujisaki, the instigator of this outing, leaned in close to Rohan and murmured, "You're blushing, sir." Laughter hung on the words.
I'm not accustomed to seeing this much female flesh," he murmured back.
"Pardon my saying so, but you need to get out more," was the response. Then John turned away to respond to another comment. Rohan watched the bubbles rising in his glass and wondered what the young aide would think if he knew that his boss did frequent less reputable establishments in Ponytown that catered to humans with a taste for the alien and the exotic. Then the hypocrisy of his anger at his wife over her infidelity struck him. He fell back on the age-old defense. Whoring was expected of men, and no woman should place a cuckoo in her husband's nest. The excuses rang hollow. John tapped his glass with a spoon. The young men fell silent, and Fujisaki stood up.
"Well, here's to Canood. Those of us who've avoided the wedded state think he's mad, and those who have entered the bonds of matrimony also think he's mad, but at least for tonight, we'll put aside such worries and concentrate on sending him off in style. So, a toast to Canood on his final night of freedom, and may it be memorable," John cried.
There were calls of,
"Hear, hear,"
from around the table. Glasses were clinked, drained, and refilled. Canood, smiling but with a hint of worry in the back of his eyes, laid a hand over his glass.
"Now go easy, fellas. I have to be in reasonably good shape tomorrow." "Not to worry, Canood," Franz said. "You're with us. And that's why I'm worried."
A waitress took their dinner orders. Booze continued to flow. Rohan found himself thinking about the inflation numbers from the Wasua star system. That made him switch from champagne to bourbon. A live band began to play, and girl after girl in various and creative outfits took to the stage. The creative outfits were shed in time to the pulsing music, and the ladies were all very... Rohan searched for a word and settled on flexible. Almost all the tables were filled now, parties of men with sweat gleaming on their faces, stocks and ties loosened, coats removed. Girls settled into laps and ran tapering fingers through their Mark's hair. The roar of conversation was basso and primal. A quintet of five girls was dancing and singing on the stage to an old Spacecom marching song, but with some interesting new lyrics. The sprightly music had Rohan first humming along and then singing along. But it was frustrating that the girls couldn't get the beat right. They were late. He began to conduct vigorously and felt his elbow connect with something.
"Whoa!"
shouted Fujisaki. There was a large wet stain on the front of his trousers.
"He's drunk,"
Rohan vaguely heard someone say.
"So what? We're all drunk,"
Franz replied.
"Yeah, but he's the chancellor. What if..."
Brett, a newly hired aide, began.
"Relax. They sweep the place regularly and keep the press out," John replied. "Yeah, relax, Brett. We're having fun. I'm fun. I'm just made of fun,"
Rohan shouted. The five ladies went trooping off the stage, their sassy little buttocks wiggling provocatively. Where are they going? Rohan asked. Where are all the lovely ladies going? He repeated, and felt a tightness in his chest at the sadness of it all. Gone to housewives, everyone, Franz said.
What an awful waste, Rohan groaned. We need an expert commission. Girls keep turning into wives. It's a scandal. We need an investigate. A drum roll cut through his slurring words. All the lights in the club went out, save for a single stabbing spotlight pinning the stage. Into that cone of light leaped a girl. She seemed to be flying, so high was her grand jetée, and the long cloak flowing behind her added to the illusion of flight. The music resumed, a primitive, urgent beat. She stood front and center, her features covered by an elaborate mask and headdress. All that could be seen was an unnaturally pointed chin and the glitter of her eyes. She caught the edges of the cloak with long claws set with light-emitting diodes and dropped it to reveal an elaborate costume, far more concealing than was usual for a stripper. Rohan wondered if the claws were sewn into gloves. She began to dance. No harsh gyrating and suggestive posing. She danced with breath-catching grace. Her arms wove patterns, and the diodes left streaks of multicolored fire in the air around her. Layers began to fall away. The crowd shouted its approval as each piece of clothing fell. Another slithered to the stage floor, and a long silky tail covered with sleek red and white fur unfolded and wove around her like a dancing snake. The shouts became roars. The girl danced in close to her sweating admirers. Hands groped for her like blind babies seeing the tit, but she always eluded them, unless those reaching hands held credit spikes. Those she allowed to be thrust into the credit deck that adorned the low-slung belt that clasped her waist. Rohan sat rigid, fingers gripping the edge of the table, willing her to remove the mask. Show me, show me. She approached their table. The young men leaned across the table, spikes extended like some commercial metaphor for sex. Rohan couldn't move. He just watched as another layer fell away to reveal pale cream and red fur that covered her flanks and belly and rose like a spear point between her breasts. There was a gasp from the audience. John fell back against the booth. The Pope's holy wicker bill, he breathed.
The music quickened in tempo. Fire sparked from the tips of her long claws. The jewels and bells on the mask and headdress set up an hysterical ringing. She spun faster and faster. Then another great leap took her back center stage, legs widely braced, hands cupping her breasts. She slowly slid them up her chest, across her neck, lifted the mask and headdress, and flung them aside. She was alien and yet familiar. Rohan devoured her features, noting the tiny upturned nose with flaring nostrils, pricked ears thrusting through the wild tumble of cream and red curls. They were tufted on each point. Cat eyes of emerald green.
An alien,
Brett said, and his voice held both disgust and lust. Blackout. The lights came up. The stage was empty. Excited conversation danced around the table. Cosmetic surgery?
No. Gotta be one of those Kara half-breeds.
Thought we killed all of them.
Should've. Disgusting.
Hey, turn out the lights, close your eyes, and think of it as exotic underwear, John said with a laugh. The room seemed to be ballooning and receding about Rohan. His heart thundered in his chest, and his breath came in short pants. An erection nudged urgently at his fly. He staggered out of the booth.
Sir?
Are you all right?
Where are you going?
He didn't answer.
Wait, Tracy said. A Kara human half-breed?
There's no such thing. First off, it's illegal.
The young officer pointed at the Hajin waitress.
And second, our equipment might line up, but there's no way we'd produce offspring.
Rohan waved an admonishing finger at him.
Ah, but remember that the Kara were master geneticists.
They'd been blending genes from every known alien race long before humans arrived on the scene. They were eager to add us to the mix and couldn't believe that the League was serious when the ban on alien-human commingling was put in place.
Tracy took a sip of his drink.
He knew from his studies that the Kara had no physical norm. They tailored bodies to suit a given situation. They changed sex on a whim. For thousands of years, they had been harvesting, mixing, and manipulating the genetic material from every race they met. A task easily accomplished, since the Kara spent their lives aboard vast trading ships that traveled between systems or in the shops supplied by those ships. For the Kara, the greatest sin was uniformity. They believed that diversity was the key to survival and advancement. It had all been horrifying to the humans, and human purity became an obsession. Most genetic research and manipulation was outlawed for fear that the Kara might find a way to affect the basic human genome. Tracy said as much to Rohan. The older man shook his head.
Yes, but that didn't discourage the Kara. They found volunteers, disaffected humans hostile to the League, and produced several thousand half-breeds.
He picked up his glass and set it down over and over, linking the circles formed by condensation into a concentric pattern.
So why make this girl look so different? Tracy asked. They could have made the offspring look like anything, even exactly like a human.
Rohan looked up.
And that was their mistake. That's what they should have done. Instead, they tried to temper any backlash by tweaking the genes to make the children attractive to humans, or at least what they thought would be attractive. They had noticed that we like cats, hence Sammy.
Rohan refilled his glass and took a long pull.
What they didn't realize was that it would make the kids just that much more horrifying.
But you weren't disgusted by Sammy?
Samarith. Her full name was Samarith.
And no, I wasn't disgusted, but I had a taste for the exotic.
They knew that and used it. Rohan's stomach was roiling, his head pounding. Swaying, he made his way through the anteroom and out onto the street. The sea-tinged air cleared his head somewhat. He found the corner of the building and went looking for the stage door.
What are you doing?
The rational part of his mind wailed.
I'm going to compliment her on her dancing, he said aloud. And ask her about her life, explore her thoughts, share her dreams, fuck her blind.
He found the side entrance and entered. Inside, the smell of sweat and rancid makeup seeped from the walls and hung in the air. Rohan swallowed hard and tried to find his way past the lighting control panel. He turned down a hall and found himself pressed against the wall as a gaggle of girls came hurrying past, heading for the stage. In the confines of that narrow space, they rubbed against him. He could feel the warmth of their bare skin even through his clothes, and his erection hardened again.
He found another hallway, but this one was guarded by a tall man with a pendulous belly. Rohan tried to walk past and was blocked. The bouncer's exposed biceps displayed military tattoos and muscle now overlaid with fat. The overhead lights gleamed on his shaved head.
Where do you think you're going?
I wish to see the young lady who just finished performing.
You and every other Aristo.
The man glanced down at Rohan's crotch.
Who stores his brains in his cock?
Rohan gaped at him.
My good man, you can't address me in that way. Yeah, I can. And if you want to see Sammy, it'll cost you.
He thrust his hips forward, displaying his credit deck. It didn't have the same effect as when the dancers did it. Rohan dithered, remembered that gammon little face, unlimbered his credit spike, and paid.
Where can I find her?
Rohan asked.
Follow your prick. It seems to be doing a pretty good job as a dowsing rod.
The bouncer stepped aside, and Rohan walked down the hall, checking each room as he came to it. Giggles and a couple of lewd invitations were received as he opened and closed doors. Hers was the fifth dressing room he checked. She was dressed in a deep green robe and seated at a dressing table. The bottom drawer had been pulled out and she rested a bare foot on it. The robe had fallen aside, revealing the shapely leg almost up to the hip. Smoke from the stem she held languidly in one hand swirled like a halo about the tips of her pricked ears. She raked him with a long glance from those amazing green cat eyes. How much did you pay?
I beg your pardon.
To Dahl. How much did you pay him to get back here?
300.
You got taken. He would have let you in for half that.
I'll remember that next time.
Samarith lit a new stem and regarded him. Rohan shifted uncomfortably from foot to foot.
Don't you want to know why I'm here? He finally asked.
She let her gaze drift down to his crotch. You're giving me a moderately sized hint. His erection deflated.
Oh, I broke it, she drawled.
I wanted to invite you to supper, Rohan said.
Courtship first. Well, that's a change. She stood and stubbed out her stem. It's a pretty good place in Ponytown that serves late.
I was going to take you to the French Bakery.
It was the capital's best restaurant. He thought it would impress her. She laughed. You're such an idiot. Kind of sweet, but an idiot. He gaped at her. It's better if I keep a low profile.
Your profile wasn't very low tonight, Rohan shot back.
This is a strip joint. It may be frequented by your set, but it's still a strip joint. Waving me around in public wouldn't be good for either of us. And who are you, by the way? Which scion of a decaying noble house are you?
How do you even know I'm FFH?
Oh, please. Scorn etched the words. He thought about his job and the stress that carried. He thought about his cold and distant wife.
Can't I just be Rohan for tonight?
She cocked her head to the side, an endearing sight, and considered him. Her tone was gentler as she said, All right. I'll call you Han, and you can call me Sammy, and tonight we'll pretend we aren't who and what we are.
And after tonight?
Rohan asked. That depends on how tonight turns out.
Rohan
allowed Sammy to issue directions to his Hajin chauffeur, Hob. Neither he nor Hob intimated by word or action that they were familiar with the area, but he knew it well. His favorite massage spa was just a few streets over. It was a place where men with his tastes could feel the touch of the exotic. He liked the way the soft play of fur and the rough pads of an Isanjo masseuse tickled his skin and kneaded his muscles. That night, the summer heat had broken, and it was pleasant to be outside. Humans, Hajin, Isanjo, Tapani flutes, and slunkies roamed the streets listening to musicians performing on street corners. They played games of chance or skill, everything from chess to craps, to a swaying grove of flutes playing their incomprehensible stick game. Diners lingered in the restaurants. Lovers cuddled on benches in a small park, while the elderly sat and contemplated the ships lifting off from the Cristobal Colon spaceport. Hob opened the flitter doors for them. Rohan stepped out and felt the rumble underfoot as another spaceship leaped skyward. The fire from engines was a red-orange scar ripping the darkness. For a brief moment, it almost eclipsed the light from the nebula floating overhead. The long lines and evident elegance of the flitter drew more than a few looks. "I'll call you when we're ready to be picked up," he said softly to Hob. The Hajin bowed his long, bony head, revealing his golden mane between his collar and hat. Rohan turned to Sammy. She wore slim-legged pants tucked into high boots and a silk top of varying shades of green and blue that was tied in interesting ways to make it drape and flow. The cream and red hair tumbled over her shoulders. She drew looks. Rohan struggled for breath. "So where would you like to eat?" he asked. "There." She pointed at an Isanjo restaurant. Potted trees dotted the space with webs of rope slung between them. Isanjo, using hands, their prehensile feet, and their tails, darted along the woven lines. Somehow, none of the items on the trays tilted, slipped, or fell. They settled into woven rope chairs, and a waiter slithered down the trunk of the tree next to their table. His order pad hung on his neck along with a credit deck. "Drink?" he asked, the muzzle making him lisp the word. "Champagne," Rohan said. "Actually, I don't like champagne," Sammy said.
"Oh, your pardon. What would you like?"
"Tequila."
The waiter turned dark, wide eyes to Rohan. Their blackness against the gold of his fur made them seem fathomless and terribly alien.
"I'll drink what the lady is drinking," Rohan said, making it an act of gallantry. With a bouncing leap, the creature was up the tree, gripping the ropes and racing away.
"You just full of courtesy, aren't you?" Sammy asked. "Do you even like tequila?"
"Well, enough."
"What do you drink at home?" she asked,
fixing those emerald cat eyes on him.
"Champagne, martinis. In the summer months, I'll drink the occasional beer or gin and tonic, wine with dinner. Why do you ask?"
"How often do you drink?"
"Every night," he blurted before he could help himself. "And why the interrogation? You sound like my doctor."
"Do you drink to relax or to forget, or both?"
"You make too much of this. I drink because I enjoy a drink in the evenings. That's all."
Though he found himself remembering the night 5 weeks ago when he'd heard Juliana's tinkling laugh as she flirted with the young officer who was currently inhabiting her bed. He had drunk himself into insensibility that night. Another Isanjo landing next to the table caused Rohan to start and pulled him from his brooding reverie. A bowl of dipping sauce and pieces of bread were slapped down on the table. The pungent scent of the sauce set Rohan's eyes and mouth to watering.
"You are drunk tonight," Sammy said, and popped a piece of bread into her mouth. "Otherwise, you would never have come backstage."
"Do you rate your charm so low?"
"I rate your sense of propriety a good deal higher," was the dry reply.
"Well, you're probably right about that," Rohan admitted.
"So, why did you come?" "Because you're beautiful, and I'm lonely. And do you think two bodies clashing in the dark will alleviate that?" she asked.
He was embarrassed to discover that his throat had gone tight. He swallowed past the lump, coughed, and said, "Are you propositioning me, young woman?" He hoped his tone was as light as the words.
"No, you have to do that. I still have some pride left. Not a lot, but some."
"You find your profession to be demeaning?"
The look of contempt and incredulity almost cut. He looked away from those blazing green eyes.
"Well, I think you answered that question." Sammy shrugged.
"It's this state religion of yours. Women are either Madonnas or whores."
"And which are you?" he asked, deciding to hit back. It was the right move. She gave him an approving smile.
"Whichever you want."
"Oh, I doubt that. I think you're not at all accommodating," Rohan said. Their drinks arrived. She lifted hers and smiled at him over the rim of her glass.
"For an aristo, you're not at all stupid."
"Thank you. And for a stripper, you're not at all common." They clinked glasses. She sipped. Suddenly nervous, he threw his back in a single gulp.
"Whoa, slow down there, Caballero. Otherwise, I'll be carrying you out of here."
"My driver would handle that," Rohan said.
"Yes, but he can't handle propositioning me," Sammy retorted. She picked up her menu. "Shall we order? I'm famished."
She made love as well as she stripped. Rohan rolled off her with a gasp and a groan. Shudders still shook his body. She sat up, straddled him, and raked her mane of hair back off her face. She drew a forefinger down his nose, traced the line of his lips, stroked his neck, and then rubbed his paunch. Futilely, Rohan tried to suck in his gut. She chuckled deep in her throat, and Rohan felt his penis try to respond, then collapse in defeat. He had wanted her so badly by the time they reached her apartment deep in Sticktown where the flutes congregated. He had ripped off her clothes and shoved her down on the bed. Then, with clumsy fingers, he'd freed the clasps on his shirt, ripped loose his belt, pulled down the zipper, skinned his trousers over his hips, and fallen onto her. There had been little foreplay. He reached up and gently touched that gammon little face. "I'm sorry. That probably wasn't very good for you."
"I'm sure there will be an opportunity for you to make it up to me," she said softly and bent forward to kiss his lips. She tasted of vanilla with a hint of tequila on the back of her tongue. He rubbed his hands across her groin and stopped when his fingers hit deep twisting scars beneath the silken fur. How had he not felt them earlier? Too absorbed in his own pleasure and the sensations sweeping through his body, she froze and stared down at him.
"What?" he began.
"I was on Insham."
He yanked back his hands as if he'd been the one who had applied the knife and cut away her ovaries.
"Of course, I'm one of the lucky ones.
neutered beats dead. The words were flat, matter-of-fact. He found himself making excuses, offering the party line. It was the action of one overzealous admiral. The government never... We stopped it as soon as word reached us.
But not before 3,762 children were killed. Do you know how many are left? He stared up at her, at the glitter in her eyes, and shook his head. 238.
You know the exact count? It was inane, but he couldn't think of anything else to say.
Oh, yes.
How did you...
One of your soldiers saved me and a few other children. He guarded the nursery, shot and killed other Spacecom troops who weren't so squeamish.
You think that's the only reason he acted? Rohan asked. Maybe he knew it was barbaric and immoral. Can't you give us humans that much credit?
You humans started it. She pressed her lips together as if holding back more words. But perhaps you're right. She paused, lost in some memory. I always wonder what happened to him. Did your government court-martial and execute him for refusing an order?
Rohan couldn't continue to meet her gaze. He turned his head on the pillow, catching a scent of lilac as his stubbled cheek rasped across the silky material of the pillowcase. No, all the troops, and there were a number of them, he added defensively, who refused the order were allowed to resign from the service without prejudice.
I'm glad. I would hate to think he died for an act of mercy.
They were both silent for a long time. None of you would have suffered if the Kara had just obeyed the law. Sammy smiled and drew her finger down the bridge of his nose.
And if they had, I wouldn't be here, and you wouldn't be lying sated in my bed.
There was no answer to that. He struggled to sit up past the curve of his belly and kiss her. She made it easy by lying down next to him and cradling his dick in her hands. Her head was on his shoulder, hair tickling his chin, breath warm against his neck. Tentatively, he asked, "Do you hate us?"
"What a silly question," she paused. "Of course I hate you."
The words landed like a blow.
"Oh, not you, as in you. Humans in general, yes. You, personally, no. Humans are mean, violent monkeys, and the galaxy would be better off if you'd never crawled off your rock. But you seem to be all right."
"You're half-human."
"Which means that I'm at least half as mean. You should keep that in mind," she said, her voice catching on a little chuckle.
"I'll keep that in mind," Rohan mumbled as sleep fell on his eyelids as soft as snowflakes. He drowsily thought back over the evening, the quick steps of her tiny arched feet, the play of muscles in her belly, the memories and the heat of her skin pressed against his had his dick hardening again. He remembered the flash of light from her claws. Unease banished torpor. Those were gloves, right? The claws, I mean, they were sewn onto gloves.
There was a sharp pricking against the soft skin of his penis. His eyes snapped open and he tried to peer past the bulge of his gut, but to no avail. He pushed up on his elbows, the pinpricks becoming stabs of pain.
"Shit!" he yelled as he saw the extruded claws inset with the diodes, the razor-sharp tips pressed against the pink, wrinkled skin of his rapidly deflating dick.
"No, they're real."
He stared up at her, now deeply frightened. She retracted the claws, then she fell onto his chest. Hair spread like a cloak across them both. He took her hand in his and inspected her fingers,
trying to see how the claws were sheathed. He noticed that the pads on the tips of her fingers were completely smooth. But then she kissed him hard, her tongue demanding, forcing past his teeth. His erection returned, and all thought about her odd hands was driven from his head.
"I won't hurt you, Han," she murmured against his mouth. "That much I promise."
Tracy stared, stricken. "We, Spacecom, killed children?"
"Yes, all but a handful." Rohan refilled his glass. "I wasn't lying to Sammy. It really did start with an overly pious and deeply bigoted admiral." He shrugged. "And some good came from the revulsion that shook the League once word of the butchery got out. The laws on aliens were relaxed somewhat." "Was this why the Kara vanished?" Tracy asked.
"Yes. Within days of the slaughter, the Kara were gone. Their shops standing empty, the freighters drifting abandoned and stripped in space, or laying derelict on various moons and asteroids, as if a great storm had swept through and tossed them aground." Rohan looked around the bar with the exaggerated care of the profoundly drunk. He leaned in across the table and whispered, the words carried on alcohol-laden breath,
"They could still be all around us, and we wouldn't even know it."
There was a prickling between Tracy's shoulder blades, as if hostile eyes or something more lethal were being leveled at him.
"That's stupid. Space is big. They probably just went someplace else, got away from us, went back to their home world. We never found it."
"In what? They abandoned their ships."
Tracy found himself reevaluating the sullen drinkers, the jovial bartender, the waitress. Did each face hide a murderous hatred?
Rohan resumed his story.
For their 2-month anniversary, Rohan gave Sammy an emerald and gold necklace. It was a massive thing, reminiscent of an Egyptian torque from old Earth, and it seemed to bend her slender neck beneath its weight. He had bought it originally for Juliana, but she had never worn it, disparaging it as gaudy and more what she would have expected from some jumped-up nouveau riche trader than a member of the FFH.
"So, I get your wife's cast-offs?" Sammy asked with a crooked little smile.
"No, that's not... I never..."
Sammy stopped the stammered words with a soft hand across his mouth.
"I don't mind. It's beautiful. And it's rather appropriate. I got her cast-off husband."
They were at his small hunting lodge in the mountains, enjoying a rare snowfall. The only light in the bedroom was provided by the dancing flames in the stone fireplace. Outside, the wind sighed in the trees like a woman's sad cries. Sammy sat up and twined her fingers through his.
"Why did you marry her? Was it arranged? Did you ever care for her?"
"I was a replacement. Her fiancé was lost along with his ship. No bodies, no debris. Just a ship and her complement of spacers gone. After an appropriate period of mourning, her father approached my father. I was the dull number cruncher. I was never going to equal Juliana's dashing Spacecom captain."
"Tell me about your father. Is he still alive?"
Hours passed. He told her about his family, the estate in the Grenadine star system, his sisters, his younger brother, his hobbies, favorite books, taste in music. Occasionally, she asked a question, but mostly she listened, head resting on his shoulder, hand stroking his chest. He talked of his daughter, Rohisa,
the one good thing that had come from his marriage. He poured himself out to her, his hopes and dreams, his secret shames and deepest desires. She never judged, just listened. Only the fire seemed to object with an occasional sharp snap as flame met resin. Over the next month, his need for Sammy rose to the level of an addiction. He left work early, returned home at dawn, if at all. The conversations continued. Unlike Juliana, Sammy seemed genuinely interested in his economic theories, as well as the name of his old fencing master. Some nights he couldn't see her. He had to escort Juliana and Rojisa to various soirees. The final night had begun that way, at the first grand ball of the season. The walls and ceiling of the enormous ballroom of Lord Polani's mansion seemed to have vanished and been replaced with the glitter of stars and the varicolored swirl of nebulas. The effect was spectacular and utterly terrifying. Guests clustered near the center of the room, avoiding the seeming emptiness all around them. It made it difficult for those who did wish to dance, to actually dance. Lady Polani was in a rage, as evidenced by her pinched nostrils and compressed lips. One of the young Misses Polani was in tears. Tomorrow's gossip would be filled with the talk of the Polani disaster. Rohan handed his empty plate to a passing Hajin servant and snagged a glass of champagne from yet another. His host approached. His long face had drooped into even more lugubrious lines. Rohan gestured at the holographic effect. It's quite stunning. Polani took a long pull of champagne. Stunning price tag, too. And everyone's terrified. But they insisted. He gave a sad shake of his head. There's no accounting for what mad notion will seize them. Rohan correctly interpreted this as a reference to Lady Polani and the couple's five daughters. It also brought back the memory of a conversation he'd had with Sammy only 3 days before. They had been walking in the Royal Botanical Garden, Sammy pausing frequently to touch and sniff the flowers. He loved to watch her. Each gesture was a sonnet, each step a song. She had gently stroked the petals on her rose and turned back to him. He had tucked her arm through his, and as they strolled, he had casually mentioned how a friend's daughter was at a discreet clinic after a very public and embarrassing breakdown at a Founder's Day picnic. She had glanced up at him, the glitter back in those strange eyes. Are you surprised? You keep your women mewed up and deny them any kind of meaningful activity. I'm surprised more of them don't go nuts. You give them nothing to think about or talk about beyond family and gossip. You never let them do anything but plan parties or attend parties, run households and raise children.
That's a schedule that would kill most men, Rohan said with a ponderous attempt at humor. Thus proving you are the stronger sex, Sammy.
On Earth, before the expansion, women were lawyers, doctors, soldiers, presidents, and captains of industry.
And space is hostile, and most planets difficult and dangerous to colonize. Women are our most precious possession. Men can produce a million sperm, but it requires a woman to gestate and deliver a child.
Rohan's voice had risen, and his breath had gone short. He wondered at his own vehemence and defense of the system. And why had he brought up Devarga's daughter? Because he feared for his own Rojisa? And those days are gone. Your conservatism will be the death of the League, Han. The Kara were right about one thing. Adapt and change. Or die.
Rohan. What? Beg pardon, I was drifting. I was just asking about the inflation figures, Polani repeated. Ugly, but let's not mar the evening with such talk.
Rohan said and moved away. He risked a surreptitious glance at the chrono set in the sleeve of his evening jacket. 40 minutes. It seemed like he'd been here for an eternity. Just a few more and he should be able to slip away and join Sammy at the street festival in Ponytown. He imagined the pungent scents of chili and roasting meats, passionate music from the street musicians, bodies moving in wild abandon to the primal beat and thrum of guitars. The imagined music clashed with the lovely but formal dance music provided by the orchestra hidden in an overhead alcove. Rohan deposited his champagne flute and moved toward the doors. To hell with it. He couldn't wait any longer. Juliana intercepted him. The hand-sewn sequins on her form-fitting dress flashed as she moved, echoing the glitter from the diamonds tucked into her dark curls. You're not leaving, are you?
Yes.
You abandoned me for your whore. Her voice was rising, the words starting to penetrate through the stately measures of the music. What are you talking about? He knew it wouldn't work. He was a terrible liar. He resorted to pleading. For God's sake, don't make a scene. And why not? You're making a spectacle of yourself with this alien puta. Brett's wife had it from Brett. She told her mother, it's all over Campo Royale, and you're a laughingstock. You had already assured that with your parade of lovers, he spat back, finally saying aloud what had lain between them and rubbed like sand in his craw. At least mine are human. People were starting to stare. Rohan looked around at the gawking faces, the soft-footed servants, the elaborate clothes. Steel bands seemed to close around him, penning him in, holding him fast. The cry of the guitars in the streets of the old city seemed faint and far away. No, he said, not certain what he was rejecting, but rejecting it all the same. He heard Juliana screaming imprecations after him as he trod down the curving crystal staircase. He found her in the streets among the beribboned stalls that sold jewelry and pottery, perfumes and scarves. The roar of voices mingled with the music. Fat sizzled as it fell from roasting meats onto the wood beneath. He clung to Sammy and buried his head against her shoulder. She brushed his hair back with a gentle hand. What's happened? Juliana knows. They all know. They'll make me give you up. He choked. And I can't. I can't. Come, she said, and taking his hand, she led him through the rollicking crowds where humans and aliens could dance and feast together, and perhaps even fall in love. She took him back to her apartment. She prepared him a drink. He slammed it down, only realizing after that there was an odd taste. The room began ballooning and receding around him. I'm sorry, Han. I wish we could have had a little more time together. Her voice seemed to echo and be coming from a vast distance. Then there was darkness. The first return to consciousness brought with it an awareness of the chill of a metal surface against bare back, buttocks, and legs. He knew he was naked and cold, and that nausea roiled his gut. He felt gloved hands pressing against his arms and the bite of a needle. Then Sammy's voice murmured soothing words, and her hand stroked his hair. He dropped back into darkness. A bright pinpoint of light glaring directly into his eye was the next memory. The light shifted from his right eye to his left and was snapped off. Concentric circles of blue and red obscured his vision as he tried to focus after being nearly blinded. This was followed by hard pressure against the tips of his fingers, another needle prick, and he slipped away again. When he awoke, he was in Sammy's apartment, lying on a bed frame without mattress, sheets, or cover. He staggered out of bed and stood swaying in the middle of the bedroom. His eyes felt crusty. Slowly, the disjointed memories returned. He looked down at the crook of his elbow. There was a small red dot, like the bite of a steel insect. His clothes were dumped on a chair in the corner of the room. He searched the pockets and found them empty. His keys, wallet, and comb were gone. Even his comb and monogrammed handkerchief had been taken.
"Just a thieving whore,"
he said, testing out the words, and then recoiled at the unfamiliar sound issuing from his throat. He had gone from a light baritone to a deep bass. His throat felt sore, and his mouth was desert dry. That's why he sounded so strange. Pressure on his bladder sent him into the bathroom. As he relieved himself, it started to penetrate. Every vestige of Sammy was gone. No toothbrush, no hairbrush, no makeup, even the delicate perfume bottle he'd bought her, all gone. But if it had been nothing more than a con, why had she waited so many months and through so many encounters before robbing him? He staggered to the sink to wash his hands and splash his face, and recoiled from the image in the mirror. A stranger looked back at him. The frightened eyes staring out at him were now a pale gray. His hair was dark and straight rather than reddish and curly. His forehead was much higher because this alien hair seemed to be rapidly retreating toward the back of his neck. His skin tone was decidedly darker, nose larger and bulbous on the tip, ears clipped closer to his skull. His real ears had been rather protuberant. He looked down. His belly was larger, and the birthmark on his left hip was gone. He stumbled back to the toilet and vomited until he was reduced to dry heaves. Whimpering, he returned to the sink, rinsed out his mouth, and gulped down water, then stared at his hands. His wedding ring and the heavy signet ring with the family crest were missing. His gut twisted again, but he managed to keep from hurling. Back in the bedroom, he snatched up his clothes with trembling hands and started to dress. Because of his weight gain, he couldn't close the top clasp on his trousers, and the straining buttons on his shirt gapped open enough to reveal skin. He left the bedroom and found the living room to be equally void of any trace of the occupant. On an impulse, he checked the kitchen. All the dishes, utensils, and food were gone. In this room, he was more aware of a faint disinfectant smell, as if every surface had been washed down with bleach. He made his way down the stairs and out into the street, where he stood blinking in the sunlight. He had lost a night. Then he realized that heat and humidity pounded at his head and shoulders. Sweat bloomed in his armpits and went rolling down his sides. It was high summer. When he'd come looking for Sammy the night of the ball, it had been a cool fall night. Dear God! He had lost months. He needed to get home. But how to accomplish that journey loomed monumental. No money, no calm, no proof that he was who he claimed to be, not even a face. He guessed it was about 20 miles from Ponytown to the Cascades and his mansion. He didn't think he could walk 1 mile, much less 20. Still, he wouldn't know until he tried. He walked away from the building. He tried not to, but he looked back several times until its salmon-colored stucco was hidden by other structures. 2 hours later, his feet were a mass of stabbing pain, and he felt the wetness of a burst blister. He saw the glowing shield that indicated a police station and realized that he was an idiot. He had been kidnapped, assaulted, surgically altered. The police would help him. They would call his home, Hob would arrive with the flitter, and he would be whisked away from all this. And the hue and cry would be raised for Sammy. Rohan swallowed bile. It was unfortunate, but necessary. The creature deserved nothing less. He walked into the precinct house.
"I need to report a crime,"
he announced to the desk sergeant. The man didn't even look up, just pushed over an e-tablet.
"Write it up. Bring it back when you're done."
When he presented his name and title in his aristocratic accent, the man became a good deal more attentive. His eyes did narrow with suspicion as he studied the ill-fitting clothing, but the sergeant offered coffee and water. It would never do to offend if Rohan really was a member of the FFH. Mollified, Rohan settled into a chair and typed up his experiences. The beverages were supplied, and the desk sergeant sent the report up to his superiors. A few minutes later, a captain arrived. He walked up to stand in front of Rohan and called over his shoulder to the desk clerk.
"Don't follow politics, do you, Johnson? This is not the Chancellor. As I indicated in my report, my appearance has been altered," Rohan said. "And I just talked to the Chancellor's office, and according to John Fujisaki, the Chancellor's aide, the Conde is in a meeting with the Prime Minister. Now get out of here and try your con someplace else."
Rohan just kept staring up at the officer, trying to process the words. His removal was then expedited by the arrival of two burly officers who frog-marched him out of the building. Panic lay like a stone on his chest. Rohan gasped for breath. He stood on the sidewalk, blocking the flow of humanity and staring back at the police station. Eventually, he resumed his slow march toward home. He was getting odd looks because of his formal, too small evening attire in the middle of the day, and his limping progress wasn't helping. A Hajin message runner gave him a somewhat sympathetic look. Rohan gathered his nerve and approached the alien.
"Excuse me, I've been robbed, and I need to make a call. May I borrow your comm? If you'll give me your name, I'll see that you're compensated once I have access to my funds."
The Hajin handed over his comm.
"Of course."
The creature ducked his head, his forelock veiling his eyes.
"And you don't have to pay me."
The sudden kindness in the midst of the nightmare had tears stinging his eyes.
"Thank you."
Rohan forced the words past the lump in his throat. He took the offered comm and called his private line at the exchequer. John answered.
"Chancellor's office, Fujisaki speaking."
"John," Rohan said. "John, listen. I'm in a nightmare, I think."
"Who is this?"
"It's Rohan. I know it sounds incredible." The line went dead. Numbly. Rohan handed back the comm to the Hajin. "Thank you," he said automatically. One should always show respect to one's inferiors. He turned and continued walking. At the house, he didn't even attempt to explain the situation to the butler. Instead, he shoved the elderly Hajin aside and ran, panting, up the long, curving staircase. Behind him were rising cries of alarm. He raced through Juliana's mirrored and gold-inlaid dressing room. Her Asanjo maid clutched a discarded ball gown against her chest and gazed at Rohan from wide, frightened eyes.
"Where is she? Where's my wife?"
The creature reverted to her alien nature and went swarming up the drapes to cower on the rod. The large golden eyes shifted toward the bedroom door. Rohan stormed through. He was met with the sight of an expanse of bare white back, a few freckles on the shoulders. The man propped himself on his forearms, his doughy behind, pumping in an age-old dance. A woman's soft cries emerged from among the tumbled pillows. Juliana opened her eyes, looked at Rohan, and let out a piercing scream. The man who had been plowing her gave a grunt and pulled out.
"What in the hell?"
he roared, and now Rohan finally saw his face. It was him. The authorities arrived and took away the madman. I kept trying to make them understand, to realize that the Kara had placed an agent at the very heart of government. No one would listen. I would show them articles that proved what the imposter was doing, sending money to companies that I knew were fronts for the aliens. An audit would have revealed that funds were missing, redirected, but they wouldn't listen. Eventually, I realized if I ever wanted to be released, I had to end my accusations. I also knew that in the sanatorium, I was at greater risk of being assassinated. I needed to get free. Once I was released, I headed to the outer worlds. Here, I tell this story to people like you. He rose to his feet, swaying. I am Rohan Danilo Marcus Aubrey Conde de Vargas, and I adjure you to act. Inform your superiors. Alert them to the danger. He seemed to have expended all his strength in the ringing call to arms. The drunk dropped heavily into his chair, and his head nodded toward his chest. Disgusted by his gullibility and out the cost of a bottle, Tracy pushed back violently from the table. The shriek of the chair legs on the floor brought Rohan, or whatever his name might be, out of his stupor. The drunk belched and raised his head.
Whoa!
Nice! What a scam. He, Tracy jerked a thumb at the bartender, sells more booze, and you get to drink for free.
Whoa, whoa, whoa,
the grifter repeated. The Conde de Vargas is prime minister, second only to the emperor in power. Tracy tapped the name into the comm set in his jacket sleeve. This is the real Rohan. Tracy thrust his arm under the man's nose, showing him the photos. He waved a pudgy hand in a vague circle indicating his visage. I told you. They stole my face, my life, my wife. He made her love him again, or maybe love him for the first time. Tracy shook his head and headed for the door.
Wait,
the drunk called. The young officer looked back, and the drunken Scheherazade gave Tracy a desperate look. Your duties will take you all over League space. If you see her, tell her. Tell her. His voice was thick with unshed tears and an excess of booze. I never saw Sammy again. And I need to, need to. The man began to sob.
I love her,
Rohan said brokenly.
Love her so much.
Embarrassment, pity, and fury warred for primacy. Tracy embraced the anger, clapping slowly. Tracy said, Nice touch. The young officer stepped out into the darkness. The cold air cleared his head a bit, but he was still very drunk. He stared at the distant glow of the spaceport. Follow through on his threat? Go AWOL? He was only 21. Was it worth risking a noose to walk away from casual insults and petty condescension? And he realized that he could far too easily become that pathetic drunk in the bar,
telling fantastic stories for the price of a drink. I saved the heir to the throne from a scandal that might have rocked the league. We shared a secret love. I know that Mercedes de Arango, the Infanta, loves me, the tailor's son. But his story was true, not like that bit of farrago to which he'd just been treated. And your story is any less fantastic? No. Rohan's, or whatever his name was, his story couldn't be true. If it was, then he, Tracy Belmanor, second lieutenant in the Imperial Fleet, was privy to a secret that would not just rock the League, but destroy it. He peered suspiciously into the shadowed depths of the alley to his left and saw nothing beyond the hulking shadow of a garbage container. But what if they were there, hiding among them, watching, waiting, listening? What if they decided they needed to silence him? Tracy broke into a run and didn't stop until he reached the ship. The outer hatch cycled closed, and he leaned, panting, against the bulkhead. Inside the steel and resin bulwark of the warship, his panic receded. How foolish. The whole thing had been a scam. Sammy didn't exist. The Kara weren't hiding among them. Human males were still at the apex of power. It had just been a story.